Thank you. So I won't spend too much time talking myself. I might make a few comments after each of the presenters, but I'd like to turn over to Rasmus. And just to let you know, these will be lightning talks, so Rasmus will speak for 4 minutes and everyone else subsequently following. And I'd ask you to hold all of your questions and comments until the end, and I'll collate those into a brief discussion after our panelists have given us a taste of their research. So Rasmus, would you like to start?
Yes, thank you very much. I've been asked to say a few sort of more general things about what's going on in the struggle over information in public space to frame this discussion of cyber warfare and different permutations of that. So I think one title of a book that many of you will remember from an earlier iteration of this thing we think of as a digital age is this idea that was encapsulated in the title of Clay Shirky's book, Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations. I think when we look back on that book, it's clear that Clay was right, that we are all, the 3.2 billion of us roughly who are online, are immensely empowered by digital technology, even more so the estimated sort of 20 million software developers and programmers, even more empowered. And of course, the companies that empower us are immensely profitable, and that this is an exciting new world. Only the sort of the choice of words in Clay's title is an interesting one, the subtitle, the power of organizing without organizations. And I think one of the things we'll probably be talking about today is the power of organizing with organizations, in the sense that all the large organizations that dominated the pre-digital era, of course, are still very much with us, and we shouldn't forget that they too are empowered by the digital technologies that have given each of us in this room a supercomputer in our pocket that spies on us for a living. So if we think about why there is information about public affairs, why people express opinions and tell us stories about what's going on in the world around us, of course people have personal motivations, whether these are sort of altruistic motivations as citizens or it can be professional ambitions as journalists, for example. But if we ask ourselves of why is it that large organizations invest in generating public discourse, I think we can identify sort of three ideal typical motivations. The first one, and the most important for a very long time, of course, is profit, that they do it to make money, and that there is nothing wrong with this. This is, in many ways, generates enormous resources, journalism, for example. A second motivation we can pause on for a minute on this day where the white paper on the BBC's future will be published, or maybe it has been published already, is public interest. Whether it's philanthropic from donors and individual backers, or whether it is, as in much of Western Europe, is politically mandated investment in public interest. And the last one that we shouldn't forget, which is the one that was for most of mankind's history, is the most important motivation for generating discourse about public affairs, is power. It's the exercise of power and propaganda. And Mark Lee Hunter has written very interestingly about stakeholder media, and we'll speak later today, which is, I think, as a form of media we should remember, is probably resurgent. My simple point today is that we should remember that all these different types of organizations are empowered by digital technology, only in different ways. So the for-profit ones there, clearly we are moving from the production of content towards the intermediation of content through search and social. So we have a decreasing importance, arguably, of the profit motive in terms of generating discourse around public affairs, in terms of content creation, journalism. This is becoming a less profitable business. Public interest, we can park that for a minute. That's a political decision, largely. But power, of course, is no less relevant, in some ways perhaps even more relevant today as the profit motive recedes, as we can see in country after country where the old idea of a media oligarch, the proprietor who for political reasons or for other reasons having to do with a wider business empire invests in media organizations to protect those wider interests, not to make money from the journalism itself and not to do to serve the public interest by doing journalism or producing public discourse. How will this play out? I think these the other panelists will give you some concrete examples of how these things are developing, but what we should remember, of course, is that these technologies allow us to produce more stuff, more content, more cheaply, and this is fantastic in many ways, but of course also sometimes a little bit bewildering when you're an individual citizen, because as we all notice every day, it is much cheaper to produce, and here I will betray the fact that I work at an august university by using a little bit of technical language, it is much cheaper to produce enormous amounts of what we might, in philosophical terms, call bullshit, and propagate this via digital media than it is to produce what journalists like to think of as the best obtainable version of the truth, which is quite expensive and difficult, as we heard about from the previous panelists. And how this will play out, I think, depends in part, of course, on political decisions we make collectively as citizens, including decisions about public service, but of course also decisions we make individually as citizens as to where do we spend our time, what do we pay attention to, how much time do we spend sort of deciphering the interests behind the information we are presented with? Do we understand the algorithms that surface some content and not other content, why it does so? Do we understand the consideration that goes into journalism? Do we understand the motivations of other strategic communicators? And where we spend our money, whether this is about donating to support nonprofit journalism or whether it's about buying content produced by for-profit organizations that happen to provide a public service on a private basis. So I think we'll hear some examples of how this can play out in different contexts and different sort of iterations of this from the other panelists, but this was a way, if you will, of kicking off a wider framing of this discussion about cyber warfare.
Thank you so much, Rasmus. I just wanted to make a really quick point about power that will hopefully link to and set up what Dheeraj is going to talk about. And I must make a full disclosure that the research that Dheeraj is talking about, I also participated in. And so I have, I'm kind of appearing twice on this panel, if you like. But this notion of power and the profit and the transformation of the profit motive is very interesting, I think, in what Dheeraj is going to talk about, because it links a little bit more closely to this idea about bots, which are, of course, automated elements that create or transmit information within digital, particularly within social media, but within digital media. And what I think Dheeraj is going to talk about is the ways that both the profit motive and the search for power in controlling a media discourse reappear in the context of the production of bots and are part of the accompanying kind of transformation in the media landscape. So I won't. I don't have any specific questions, but I just wanted to make that link and set you up, Dheeraj.
I have to get you to do the paper. I've got a couple of slides being an academic. Subject to the world of PowerPoint. Let's make sure this works here, even though it's lightning. Just okay, and then I just click over on there. Okay, great. Okay, magnify it there. All right, great. So you can see everyone who's involved with this. In the interest of time, I'm going to just kind of continue with the project. So first of all, I know a lot of you don't necessarily have a contextual definition of what bots are. So I thought it would be good just to kind of lay that out, but also frame what this project is about, which is partially kind of came from this idea of the moral panics associated with bots. So what we're particularly interested in this project and trying to understand what's happening with bots is to look at the particular case of social bots. So these are bots. So bots basically are these automated agents that operate in different contexts, and we're particularly interested in social media. And social bots try to be like us, right? So they have profile pictures that kind of look human. They try to do activities in online spaces that kind of look human. And the argument here is pretty simple, that social bots may be able to inject themselves into political discourse and alter human behavior. So they can be quite influential. They can also kind of infiltrate networks. So there's this sort of words of that. But there's these common beliefs, and this is kind of the heart of our project, that bots are really easy to deploy, right, in terms of political spaces. And as a result, we should panic about bot takeovers of online political discourse. That all we just have a random teenager in some room and clicks a button, and all of a sudden they can completely hijack political discourse. So in some ways, that's the one-minute introduction to why we decided to study bots in politics. So what we did is we ran this pilot study, and I could talk to you ad nauseum about this, but I'm going to try to do it in a minute, is we attached bots in particular political conversations relevant to the UK general election. So hashtag PMQS, Prime Minister's Question Time, hashtag Battle for Number 10, hashtag BBCQT. And we involved some student volunteers to actually tweet within the discourse. Now, the reason we did this is we felt a lot of the moral panics kicked up about political bots didn't come from empirical investigation. So it was more kind of this idea that was coming from policy, that was coming from perceptions of what bots were doing, or kind of thinking about what Russia and China were doing, rather than actually having some empirical data. So we went through, in terms of this pilot investigation, and what we found was what we didn't expect. We actually thought it would be really easy to get bots and really easy to influence political discourse. What we found is actually it wasn't the case. What this chart shows, and the green are accounts, Twitter accounts of our volunteers who had bots attached, and the purple is of accounts that didn't have bots attached. And what you'll see here, if you look at the numbers, is actually not much is happening in terms of the difference between accounts that had bots attached versus not. There's just a little bit more in the green in terms of following and followers. Yeah, I mean, they're small numbers, really, at the end of the day. And we actually thought going in, as a team of social researchers from three different universities with computational skills, social science skills, skills in communication and politics, and a lot of knowledge about bots, that we just get the bots, and then we will influence the political network. So what I kind of wanted to do with this experiment, and it's kind of cool to do this in a lightning talk, is actually say there's a lot of interesting challenges of studying bots, and we wanted to go through and look at this empirical data to make a point, well, kind of a couple points, that a lot of this really depends on the social and political context that you're deploying bots. And here's the big thing that I kind of want to impress upon you. Deploying bots to actually influence political discourse, and they can do that, we know they can, requires substantial financial and social capital. And we don't necessarily think that. You think you could just go online, deploy the bots, and bang. And actually what this does is it privileges people who have those substantial financial and social capital resources at their disposal. So in other words, it's a manifestation of real geopolitical circumstances, i.e., foreign governments or particular organizations that want to get in, but not academics who necessarily want to try to get in, or even media organizations. But we're talking about real power players. So to just kind of conclude, I want to use this as an opportunity to also push you guys to think in some ways of what was, in for us, a very interesting research project that got us to where we didn't think we were going to end up, is what's the relationship really between this social and financial capital and the influence of bots? And in particular, do people who have more resources, can they just purchase better bot networks and then be able to influence? So the large question I'm raising here, much as a sociologist, is what are these larger socioeconomic factors that could be influencing political discourses through bot networks? So that's my quick lightning talk on what we've done. Happy to discuss it later in discussion or at coffee.
Thanks, Dheeraj. I also feel like I could talk about this study for ages, but I think what I wanted to do in terms of thinking about this particular bot study and then the confounding of our expectations as researchers is really to reiterate some of the things that Rasmus was raising. So if there is a case that control of a public online conversation is possible through computational investment, we really need to think as researchers and also as media producers about who might be wishing to control these conversations in which ways. And this is a really interesting challenge because it becomes an interdisciplinary one. One of the ways to answer those questions is to work together with people who are computational researchers who can help you to understand how people currently test for bots. So the genesis of this project was that one of our research partners from the University of Southampton, who works in computing, had presented a way of testing to identify when bots were changing the behavior of a social network. And so I think this is a really interesting challenge for us to take forward as researchers and as practitioners, to kind of bring in different types of expertise to help us to reveal the new shape of the media landscape. I think this is a nice place to turn over to who's next? Raphael, who's going to talk about the consequences of this transformation for journalists.
Sure. I'm at a bit of a disadvantage compared to some of the other panelists because I've had relatively little interaction in my kind of personal experience with bots. but some of the people that I work with have. And to kind of build on what Dheeraj said about, or Allison talked about kind of how you can deploy computational power to try and influence the discourse, what I've seen is it's very rarely just raw computational power that's poured into, for example, Twitter and other social network. It's often a combination of that and something that we would that everybody in this room would recognize as kind of more naked exercise of power. So that can involve taking somebody into a room and beating them up until they give you their Facebook password, and then you turn them into a bot. You piggyback on their pre-existing social network in order to disseminate kind of messages that you want to do that. So we've seen that kind of thing, for example, in places like Syria, which is an active conflict zone, and where one of the first things that happens when an activist is arrested is they're beaten until they give up their social networking passwords. And then that can then be used to infect other people in the network, because once you've impersonated somebody on Facebook, you can then go and find their friends. It's right there in their friend list. You introduce yourself. You say, "Hi, this is Amar. This is Mohammed. I've just been released, or haven't talked in a while. Here's what's going on. Or hey, would you like to open this email or look at this great video that I found?" That kind of thing. And so it's very, very rarely just somebody sitting creating kind of fake profiles on the wire and then using those to seed a message, in part because those fake profiles will just exist in a vacuum. And unless you have very, very gullible people kind of who are picking up on that message, or unless your messaging is extremely advanced, it's hard to break into kind of real, the world of real Twitter users or real Facebook users. So oftentimes it helps if you can actually just kind of break in by taking over somebody's account. That's what I've seen overwhelmingly. And I've seen it from two angles, and I'll try and get into that. Both of these are public examples. They're stuff that I or my colleagues have written about working at AP. One is that you will try and attack a journalist directly. And this often happens, believe it or not, through conference invitations. Journalists love conference invitations. They love travel. They love the idea of free accommodation and free food. And I know I do. This happened to a colleague of mine who was working in Vietnam. He was invited to a conference by somebody allegedly working for Oxfam. He figured out that something was wrong when he saw that the address was something to the effect of oxfam.gr.int rather than oxfam.org or whatever the usual URL is. And so he didn't click on the link to the supposed conference. Instead, he sent it over to a specialist. The specialists looked at the link, and they realized that these conference invites had gone out to other people as well. They all fit a certain profile. These were people who were active on Vietnamese social media. They were people who had blogs. One person had clicked on the link, and her blog was taken over. And I mean, this example is a little bit old, but so it predates a little bit what we see with microblogging, Twitter, Instagram, that kind of thing. But the principle is the same. Her blog was taken over, and it was used to spread disinformation. And that disinformation was very clumsy, so it didn't spread. But you can see how it can be used to kind of seed. It was weeks before, by the way, she was able to take over her. Regain control of her blog. So this kind of stuff can, you often have the idea that, well, look, if somebody hacks me, I can just get back in there. But in fact, especially in a country like Vietnam, where it's not so easy to have recourse to an American social media company, you can persistently impersonate people online. And that has serious consequences for their social networks. In her particular case, she stopped blogging. She lost a lot of credibility. And people don't speak to her as often as they used to. So this can, in fact, have a real-world impact. The other example that I've seen, and this is a more recent one, and this is somebody who was very active on Facebook in Ecuador, a guy named Dr. Carlos Figueroa. He's an opposition leader or an opposition activist in Ecuador. And we were able to get in touch with him after the Hacking Team leaks, which some of you may be familiar with. This is an Italian surveillance company who found themselves being hacked and having all their emails put online, including their customer support emails. So we were able to see, not quite in real time, but we were able to see very recently Ecuadorian intelligence officials contacting hacking team and saying, you know, we've tried everything. This guy's just not clicking on the links. You know, how do you suggest that we do this? And then patiently the hacking team rep kind of walks them through the process of infecting an opposition leader. And they say, okay, that's a great idea. Okay, is this okay? And then they showed the various kind of like their draft emails that they were using to try and infect this poor guy. He's an oncologist, he's a doctor. And so they invited him to an oncology conference in Chicago. It was a fake conference. But they were very sure, they noted in big capital letters that accommodation would be paid for, that flights would be paid for, and food would be paid for. So, you know, I can see how attractive that was. In the end, I don't know if that was the successful email or not, but in the end, he was hacked, he was arrested, and in the interim, his social media profiles were taken over. And those were used to spread, to seed pro-government messages. He was the only example that we were able to confirm, but with all the emails, we also saw other bait documents, other fake emails that were aimed at others. So emails that had to do with environmental issues, emails that had to do with groups like Anonymous. And so you had an idea, even though we didn't know the specifics, we had an idea of the breadth of this kind of campaign. So this is just to say is that there's often, you know, people often focus on the cool automated nature of how this works. Oftentimes, when you look at the exercise of power, behind the scenes, it still happens in very raw ways, with people just showing up at someone's house, arresting them, and then hijacking their social networking presence.
Thank you. My only question, and maybe you don't have time to get into this now, is what kind of counter power could you imagine building against this? I was speaking to an activist friend yesterday, and she said, I feel like there's an increase of what I can only imagine are coded messages on Facebook that don't appear to have any meaning to me personally, but I am sure that they are instructions or fail-safes against these kinds of actions. I don't know if you've encountered anything like this or whether you have seen other ways for people to kind of either preempt this sort of takeover or respond to it.
It's extraordinarily difficult, and I've seen a huge amount of carelessness. I think that some people are aware of the risks and how difficult it is, but because surveillance is so invisible, it's very hard to take even people who are at great risk to take it seriously. So, I mean, just one recent example is that somebody who is working with a well-known Syrian activist group that is under a threat of assassination, several of their members have already been killed. I begged the guy to say, like, is there any way that you could maybe tone down your social networking presence? You've got your real name online. You know, certainly you can still spread your message without having to do that. And he refused. And now this was a little while ago. I think that since then that's been moderated. I don't know. Some people are doing it. I've experienced a lot of personal frustration in terms of trying to get people to take that kind of thing seriously.
Thanks. Sam, I want to give you a chance to share your research, and then we'll open out to questions from the floor.
Sure. I'll try and be brief here, but I manage a project called the Computational Propaganda Research Project that sort of broadly explores the way that bots and more generally algorithms are being harnessed for political uses worldwide. So we've been doing a bit of comparative study on this subject for about 2 years at the University of Washington, and now we're moving to Oxford Internet Institute to do a longer 5-year study. I think I'd love to be able to connect all of the talks. We'll see how I do on that. but I think that to speak to what Rasmus mentioned, which is the sort of resurgence of power in a different way, I think that bots speak to this very interestingly. So they are very pervasive. They can tweet out millions of tweets in a day. They don't have temporal constraints. They are tireless. And this sort of speaks a bit to what Dheeraj is speaking about, you know, well, then you see that and you think perhaps bots can have a immediate and tangible effect on political discussions. And what you've realized is no. You need to have social capital and you need to have money. And I would add another thing, you need to have time. You need to have people that have time to do these sorts of things. There's a little story about a guy in the United States. Right now I'm studying the way that bots are being used in the U.S. election, and there's this guy that made a lot of money through a startup and now wants to affect politics, and so he uses bots to sort of win every conversation about all of the different political happenings in the United States using bots. He has a lot of time and a lot of money. I don't know about the social capital. that's just my bias.
But is his name Donald?
it rhymes with drum. no, not really. Not Donald, but that's a whole other can of worms. So what we've tried to do and how we've tried to build understandings of this thing is to talk to the people that make the bots. So for the last 2 years, I've been traveling around the world talking to people that are coders and builders of this technology, discussing with them, A, how do you do it? B, why do you do it? C, who's paying you? And what the purposes of these bots are. And I think that this is something that we need to discuss. So Dhiraj, I have the benefit of being able to read the paper that Dhiraj et al. Produced. And so I can say that there are bots out there that are used in political circumstances by governments, by corporations, by militaries to simply interrupt the conversation, so to send millions of spam messages in Syria, for instance, during the Syrian civil war, just to interrupt what's going on and to prevent communication channels amongst activists and people who are using non-traditional communication channels to communicate for whatever reason. But then they're also used to pad follower lists of politicians. We've heard this a million times, like Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump both have over 50% fake followers on Twitter. And what does that do to bandwagon effects? Maybe nothing, maybe something. It's really difficult to measure as a social scientist, right? And then also now we have bots that can be coded using machine learning tactics that can engage, that actually speak to people about things that they're concerned about. And this has kind of grown out of the advertising industry. Rasmus spoke a lot about the power of the corporation and like the corporation's role in news media. And bots have grown out of advertising and these sorts of businesses, the ability to send out messages as much as possible. And now we have micro-targeting in advertising. Well, we also have micro-targeting in politics as well. I sat in on a unnamed political candidate's digital team meeting recently, where they talked about using bots to micro-target voters based upon like specific concerns in a very propagandistic way. And this kind of is a segue into something else, which is what Raphael was talking about, which is what I'd like to call like semi-human interaction on social media and semi-human propaganda. So yes, we have on the one hand traditional techniques of beating up journalists and getting their information, and on the other hand, massively automated techniques. I think what you're going to see in the future and what we're seeing right now is the most scary and pervasive tactic is using combinations of cyber armies, people in China, Russia, Israel, United States, wherever you want to talk about, UK, and bots. So deploying sets of bots, getting them to chat with people about politics during political crises, and then when someone starts talking to them, have a human take over and start talking to them and writing with them. That's what cheap labor does for you. So thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. What a fascinating panel. I'm so pleased to have been able to chair. I think we've got about 10 minutes, which is long enough to have a proper conversation. So I think I'd like to just open the floor to questions. What I'll do is I'll collect a clump of questions, and we can sort of discuss all of them in turn. That way we can hear from more of you. We've got in the middle.
This is a question for Sam, really. I'd just like to hear a little bit more about what you found out from the makers of the bots. What were the main tactics they were using? You mentioned time, for example. So, you know, is it just really flooding conversation across a period of time so much so that, you can't help but see a single or multiple messages from a particular motive?
Okay.
Testing.
Yeah. There you go.
I'm just curious, Sam, are you seeing anybody using bots for small organizations? You know, I mean, what's the use there? You're talking about really giant players there. Is there any kind of leveling of the playing field going on in this technology?
I'd say so, and I'm going to speak to that this afternoon. I'm doing a little workshop about how people like you and me can use bots to fight back. So, yeah, I'll get more into that.
The academics will be attending in order to figure out how we can better improve our chances at changing political conversations. Okay, a third question? Okay, so...
I'm just picking up on what you said at the end. Is it worth it? $200,000 can get you a columnist at pretty much any leading newspaper in terms of opinion formation. $200 million buys you the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. In terms of, I can understand bots for automated swamping of a conversation to shut it down, but in terms of the careful, the nuance, the artistic concern trolling and sort of agenda weaving, isn't it easier just to use people and cheaper?
Okay, so that was a really nice clump of questions, because we've got sort of questions about bot making and tactics for making bots. And I think, Duraj, you might also be able to talk about what we failed to do in our study. The question about leveling of playing field using technology, or whether this technology actually just intensifies the differentials between powerful organizations and rich individuals or organizations. And this question of whether or not investment in technology to change political opinion is more valuable than investment in more traditional means of shifting opinion formation.
Do you want to go? You want to start?
I can, yeah, because you've got more
rock and roll.
Interest,
yeah.
You know?
No.
Well, I don't think the LSE ethics board would have been happy if we kidnapped people, took over their social media accounts, and attached bots to them. But we probably would have been more successful in terms of infiltrating political discourse, which I think speaks to your point as well. Sam, some of the other things I think that we recognized we failed to do, which kind of speaks to some of the questions about money as well. You know, if you did throw $200 million into bots, you know, what would happen? And part of this is a question of then how much financial resource you put in and then what you can actually get. And that's something we don't quite know in terms of where you have to get to in terms of money, where you have to get to in terms of time, and where you have to get to in terms of social capital or technical sophistication. So there's a certain interesting combination here, and maybe some optimization, and probably a good segue to Sam, your commentary there, that we couldn't quite figure out at a small scale.
Sure. So to pick up on the last question first about traditional techniques and methods for influencing public opinion, I think that someone that I spoke to, a campaign manager of a major political campaign, said it best to me, which was that we still treat digital like the Wild West. Whatever we can do, we'll do it. We'll throw money at it. We'll put money into it. We don't know what the effects are a lot of the times, but I would say that the effect is contextual, right? So if you're in Venezuela, for instance, or if you're in Ecuador, and you know that people are going to access Twitter for certain means, then it might be more useful than it is in the United States. The thing that's really tricky to measure is the behavior thing. So we can't quite say what the effect is in the way that we can speak about traditional media effects, because we've studied it for so many years, but we can say that it's happening, and it's happening worldwide. The second thing about small organizations using Twitter bots are people, loan sharks, using Twitter bots. Journalists have used this to great success, and also activists as well. The Black Lives Matter movement has a bot called Stay Woke Bot that talks about Black Lives Matter issues. There's journalists that use bots to tweet on gun control way more often than journalists actually could. So every minute, this is what everyone's stances are in Congress on gun control in the United States. And there's also organizations like Planned Parenthood and other movers and shakers in the United States, and some smaller, that are using bots in a very interesting way. And I will speak to this more in the afternoon. What was the third question? What are the main tactics? So we've been building kind of like a typology or a classification system of what bots do. And so the tactics are, one, padding followers. Two, false flagging, which basically is buying bots for your opponent to make them look like they are desperate for attention. And this has happened a lot. Three, using bots as a sort of roadblock, a spam tactic, to just spam massively so that basically conversations surrounding a specific hashtag get very garbled. And then the fourth one is the more sort of tactical, direct way of like using bots to specifically have conversations with people by running and through and looking at who the influencers are based upon specific conversations. And so there's a paper released by DARPA doing a project with anti-vaccine activists recently that speaks exactly to this kind of manipulation. Yeah.
Okay. So are there other further questions from the floor for any of our panelists? Yes. In the middle here.
I was wondering if you could give us some of your thoughts on Microsoft's Tay. And also the role of how machine learning and bots are combining to influence political discourse, especially from trying to learn from the social.
Okay, great. Other questions? Down in the front. Yeah, I'll take three, and then because we've only got 5 minutes left.
Hello. Okay. All right. Okay. My question is: does the application of bots is only limited to Twitter, or has it also has spread to other social media platforms such as Facebook or Instagram? Thank you.
Okay. Last chance for a final question. Okay.
I was just going to ask: which you think is more pervasive, bullshit or bots? And which do you think more dangerous?
Okay, last question. Yes.
There's an assumption that's slightly died out now, which is that individuals can be propagandized in a simplistic way, whereas in fact, especially through social media, we appropriate the information that we get through the social networks. Have algorithms and bots been able to actually do that effectively, evaluate the social network and how people appropriate that information as opposed to just being individualized and targeted in a advertising way?
Okay, really interesting questions. The sort of question about the entire social context across a network, a question about different contexts for bots, and a question about the role of machine learning in relation to bots. And then I will ask all the panelists for any final comments that they have before we close.
Rasmus, you should talk about bullshit and bots. Yeah. Bullshit versus bots.
Sure. I mean, I think there is a, you know, you can think of different kinds of bullshit, right? So I think the most pervasive form of bullshit is what we might think of as sort of disinterested amateur bullshit, which is what I produce every day myself, for example, in conversation, which I don't do to further any particular goals or achieve anything, but it's just sort of part of everyday interaction. I think that's relatively innocent. I mean, maybe people disagree, but I think that's relatively innocent. I think what's more worrisome is the sort of the self-interested generation of bullshit that crowds out other kinds of conversation, whether that bullshit is public discourse, it can be sort of marketing speak, it can be propagandistic or political and whatnot. And I think one of the things that is interesting that Sam and others' research speaks to is when you sort of leverage the power of technology to auto-generate that or generate that on a much larger scale enhanced by technology. I think there's one set of questions around whether you can influence people's attitudes and behavior at an individual level, which I think, you know, the research that was reported here, you know, suggests that that's very hard. I think the bigger issue, I suppose, is what are the institutional implications when you essentially are distorting the entire structure of a communication platform, which I think we're seeing on Twitter on a very large scale, which leads then to the question of what kind of measures are put in place to prevent that. And I think that was very interesting, the question about whether this is specific to Twitter. I mean, I think there are other social networking sites and other social media platforms that have been better at preventing this from becoming as pervasive as it is on Twitter. But of course, those platforms may only be less suffused with bullshit until someone with enough resources and strong enough incentives to change that comes along. So,
I could speak to a couple things. So first of all, to the Tay debacle with Microsoft. So I came in from Seattle yesterday, which is where Microsoft is, right? Well, one of their many offices, but their headquarters. And I've had a lot of discussions with people at Microsoft about this. And I think that what they didn't do was follow the tens and tens of years of experience with bots that we know about, because bots have been around forever, right? We know that Liza was around a long time ago. You might have encountered her in IRC chat rooms. So there's a lot of things that have been said about the ways that you should build bots that Microsoft did not read before they launched Tay, and it's pretty simple, honestly. Like, if you want to read something that I wrote with a group of people much smarter than myself, we wrote a botifesto on Motherboard a few months back, and we talk about like these exact things, like this is what you should and shouldn't do. And a lot of people have spoken about that. So Tay was an interesting thing, and I think you just have to go on 4chan to realize that the internet's not that nice of a place sometimes. but then to some of the other things. Yeah, bots appear on lots of other platforms, so bots do appear on Facebook. They're less likely to appear on Facebook because you need to verify your account much more, and the API isn't open in the same way that it's open on Twitter. But basically, Facebook bots a lot of times will be a bit scarier because they steal people's identity. So one of the things we've been tracking lately is the use of criminal databases and stealing people who have felonies' identities to produce a bot. On Facebook or something like that. And I'm so jet lagged. But
the other question was about individual targeting and individual propagandization in relation to kind of the shift of opinion across a whole social network. And I think this is actually like the fantasy that Diraj and I and the rest of our team had in mind when we did our bot experiment. Yeah.
So I come from a social network analysis point of view, so I use graph theory and looking at networks and network structures. And I had looked at a lot of big networks which bots were active in, and it's used in bot detection algorithms, so you see particular structures of how bots infiltrate social networks. So we thought, okay, this is really clear in terms of structure. Then the computer scientists that we collaborated with saw, you know, bot detection in terms of frequency temporally of how they tweet. So we had all these characteristics of bots, and then thought, okay, well, if we just followed some of these things, we could put in operation. Now, one of the things we found from this also, right, is if you did have time, you did have the capital, et cetera, and you took some of these characteristics we knew were identifiers, and you combined them with advanced machine learning techniques, again, on the resources part, then is when you could start potentially shaping the conversation. But you'd also have to know what parts of the network to kind of go to in terms of that. So what we realized is, even though we kind of knew what the identifiers were, it's a pretty complex process. And then the algorithms you try to deploy are complex. And if you wanted to then infiltrate other platforms like Snapchat or Instagram, you're talking then about things like visual machine learning, which are even more sophisticated but can be deployed. So that's another thing to maybe think about as we look forward to the future of bots beyond textual social media like Twitter, is how we could use sophisticated algorithms to think about that too.
Okay, I know there's more questions, but unfortunately we have sadly run out of time. I wanted to give Raphael the last word since you didn't have any direct questions, but do you want to make a final comment?
Well, yeah, there was. I think the last question was about one of the effect. Maybe touched on the effectiveness of bots. You know, whether they actually can actually ever convince somebody. I don't know. You know, I don't know the answer, but I can know from personal experience or an anecdotal experience with other journalists that they can have a demotivational effect, which is probably one of the maybe most easiest ways that you can use a bot, just to kind of discourage somebody from speaking. And it's not just bot related. I mean, I don't know. There's some people jokingly talk about a reverse Turing test, where if a human sounds dumb enough, then actually, for all intents and purposes, they're a bot. And we encounter a lot of these bots, especially if you write. There are some certain topics, and you probably, there would be no surprise, for example, if you're in the States and you write about gun control, or if you write about Israel and the Palestinians, if you write about various other hot button issues, you will invariably on social media encounter an enormous amount of blowback, which tends to be very basic, something to the effect of "you're stupid," or "you know, I hate you," or "die," you know, things like that. Yeah. And that comes from, at least as far as, you know, up until very recently, that came exclusively from humans. And so it's not very difficult to reproduce in an automated context, and it has more or less the same demotivating effect, because even when it comes from humans, you think, you know, who is this person? It's an egg on Twitter. It's usually somebody who's got a username with like 123ABC, you know, I love you or something like that. So I don't know. That's at a very superficial level, they can, I think, even the most basic bots can have demotivating effects on a person or an entire network.
Thank you so much. This is a fantastic panel. Please join me in thanking all of our presenters.
And that at plus target audience analysis to really understand how these narratives are